A Map of the Soul by Russell T. Wright. Introduction. There have been many books written about the manipulation of reality, though perhaps no one has been so bold as to state in the title that that's what their book was all about, although Shakti Gawain came pretty close when she named hers Creative Visualization. And everything I've written here has been said before. The writer of Ecclesiastes was right when he wrote that there's nothing new under the sun. One can only hope to provide a new and different combination of information to illuminate life's path. What I'm attempting to accomplish in this book is to get you to do the experiments, after which I will provide you with philosophical ammunition so that you understand where the approach embodied by the experiments fits into the larger philosophical world. That way, when people make fun of you, you'll be able to realize that any opposition you encounter is due to sheer brainwashed ignorance on your detractor's part. But will you then argue with these people, these thoroughly brainwashed individuals? What would be the point in that? They're brainwashed. They're unable to think clearly. The problem, in other words, is in their minds. So if you're going to be doing any convincing, you'll have to get around their minds to do it, just as I'll be attempting to do with you. That's where the experiments come in. You've got to do the experiments. Otherwise, the rest of this book just won't make any sense. Some of you will be tempted to sit back and read all about the nice experiments contained herein, sit up on your high horse, and attempt to judge it rationally. And maybe, just maybe, if by the end you're convinced, then maybe you'll come back and sully yourself long enough to do these impertinent little exercises. That won't work. What follows will never convince you. Only doing the experiments can do that, and you probably won't even comprehend the rest of it without having participated in the experiments. If you think this might be your approach, then just close this book now and put it back on the shelf, because this only means that you're not ready for a change. If you're ready for a change, you definitely know it right now. You have to be ready for a change at all costs before you'll be willing to participate. If you're not, save yourself the time and money of reading this book. It won't help you. Others of you will want to read this book so you can feel good about yourselves for having read yet another book like this. You won't bother to actually do the experiments because you already get it. So, what do you need with the silly experiments? You want to talk to your friends about being up on the latest spiritual stuff. This book won't help you either, and you probably need the help the most, because no one is further from getting it than someone who thinks he does but really doesn't. Well, in that case, how would I know, you ask? By doing the experiments. You have to do the experiments. If you do them, you get it. If you don't, you don't. Simple as that. And once you do it, the results take over and fill in all the blanks for you. But don't take my word for it. Don't take my word for anything, nor anyone else's. Once you do the experiments, you won't have to. You'll never have to take anyone's word for anything ever again. I'll show you how all that plays out. An introduction to the writer. You're going to need to know where I'm coming from with all that follows. Beginning in high school, I've always been a writer of fiction. Part of that was ego. A look what I can do kind of thing. But at the same time, the writing process was a big part of helping me figure things out. And over the years, by engaging in the writing process, I've been able to develop and hone my writing skills so that at some point I might put them to good use. And I was aware of that part of the equation pretty early on because I just didn't think I had anything to say in my 20s. And I was right. Apparently, I didn't have much to say in my 30s or 40s either. At a certain point, however, as if this is what all this writing was leading up to, I had an awakening experience. I'll talk more about that later. And then I did have something to say. Pretty much all of the novelists of today have absolutely nothing whatsoever to say. Have you noticed that? Still, I stuck with fiction, writing 3 more novels after that, and collaborating on 1 translation. And they're good novels with a lot of wisdom contained in them. In fact, all the ideas in this work of nonfiction are explored in the novels I've published. But at the same time, the tendency toward fiction had a tinge of timidity to it. It's much easier to hide behind a story, weaving in the usual enigmatic truth one thinks one might have developed the skill to express, rather than come right out with it, which is much, much harder to do. And at some point, the desire to preach takes over. Preaching gets a bad rap these days. I mean preach in the best sense of the word. I mean it in the sense that one has something to say and the overwhelming urge to say it directly rather than through artifice, and the courage to say it. This book is also, in a way, a companion to my fiction. In the somewhat yin-yang arrangement, this book will help you understand what the novels are about, and the novels will give you some context for how the experiments and other ideas in this book might play out in real life. In the life coaching that I've done, and with friends and family, I've come to realize that the things I say regarding spirituality, philosophy, and science come out of left field, as the saying goes, because the people around me don't have the same perspective that I have, which is to say they haven't had this awakening experience I mentioned. Without the awakening experience, an experience I can take no credit for at all, it will always come out of left field, no matter how directly one attempts to explain it. That's where the experiments come in. Through the experiments, one can experience the same awakening that I experienced. After that, I can explain it in a way that will make sense to you. But you have to be ready for it. And quite frankly, it seems that only God or the universe or universal love, however you prefer to say it, can make you ready. Are you ready? If so, then keep reading. And even if you're not, keep reading anyway. Some of the experiments might just help get you there. A pre-experiment, the Christian caveat. You're going to have to know where I'm coming from, as I said. I have to give you all the pieces of the puzzle here, or the picture won't make any sense in the end. It may not be complete. I have to let you know that I was raised as a Protestant Christian, and when I was a child, 9 years old to be precise, I accepted Jesus into my heart and was subsequently baptized, and I have maintained an inner dialogue with God my whole life. Was this a crucial step toward the awakening experience I had much later in life? Was it a precursor? Was it a prerequisite? The truth is, I don't know. I think it probably was, but I have no way to compare it to any other life experience. I don't know if a person raised as a Buddhist or Hindu or any other religion or no religion could go on to experience the same awakening that I have. All I can say for sure is that this is how it worked for me. It's completely possible that this first step made the awakening inevitable at some point in my life. So as a sort of pre-experiment, consider inviting Jesus into your heart. It doesn't have to be anything formal, just say a little prayer. The Bible is very clear. For everyone who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, the door will be open to you. And in Revelation, that funky book about the end of days, it's very clear also. This is Jesus talking. Here I am, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person, and they with me. Then you may want to be baptized. The easiest church to do this in is probably a Baptist church, as the name implies. Give it a try. I recommend it. There is no downside to this course of action. It costs nothing, and it may benefit you infinitely. The next wicket I went through to get to a place where I can explain these experiments to you took place many years after that initial conversion experience, as it's called in Christianity. I went through a time of crisis, which I'll detail later. Out of the crisis came a decision that I made in no uncertain terms to solve the problems I was having in my life, no matter what it would take. Even at the time, as I was making that decision, I realized it was a profound moment, a turning point for me. Subsequent, and related to that turning point, I had what might be called an awakening experience. It felt like, subjective, not objective, as I'll talk about in a moment, a supernatural intervention in which all that I'm going to explain in this book instantly became clear. I'll detail this later as well. After that, I read various books that have been written on this subject, and they were very helpful in clarifying what I'd learned in that instant. but I already understood what they were talking about in a way that I never would have prior to that experience. So there are three caveats there: the conversion, the decision, and the awakening. These may be necessary precursors to understanding any of what follows. There may be nothing anyone can do to bring about the awakening experience, but maybe these experiments put us into a position in which the awakening occurs. All who ask, receive. All who seek, find. Maybe that's what these experiments are all about in a nutshell. We'll revisit this in Experiment 5 in a more general way, but I just wanted to put it out there before we get started. No surprises. Cessation of transgressive nature. One last aspect of my personal perspective that needs to be addressed is what I call a cessation of the transgressive nature. The transgressive nature is what the Bible calls the sin nature, or the flesh, depending on the translation. It's what Eckhart Tolle might call the pain body, or that unholy alliance between the pain body and the ego. I'm sure other religious traditions and spiritual teachers have their own labels for it. What I'm referring to is a desire to transgress for the sake of transgressing. Maybe you know the feeling. As St. Paul said, "I do the very thing I hate." This sense of need persisted for a very long time after this awakening experience I had, but it finally did cease. I can tell you the exact moment it happened, though there was nothing that I did to bring it about. It's another one of those things that God or the universe or love, use what word you will, has to do for you. While my life got better and better every year as a result of putting the experiments in this book into practice, not until this cessation of the transgressive nature did life really begin to come together, so to speak. There's no getting around the fact that this entity that is within us, that we are in fact, is a holy entity. Therefore, we must enter through the narrow gate, as the Bible says, a gate that is only as wide as your own body. Think about that as you go through the experiments. But in my experience, just as with the awakening moment, there's nothing you can do to bring this about. That's how it felt anyway. It could also be that it's the culmination of the work that you do in these experiments that causes the ego, the pain body, the flesh, this transgressive nature to finally give up the ghost, to say, "We give up," and pack it in. That's very possible. And of course, getting older may have had a great deal to do with it. Sin gets a lot less enjoyable as the aging process progresses. I would put an LOL here, but that would be unprofessional. Then again, there are plenty of people whose transgressive natures persist well into old age, which I'm not there yet. Old age, I mean. So, anyway, the point is there's no need to deal with your behavior on the level of rationality. You just have to be aware of it. Observe it only. Don't worry too much about it, in other words, or judge yourself for it. Just do the best you can. Over time, and perhaps miraculously in the end, it will cease, seemingly of its own volition. Germane to this context, there's a famous quote by St. Augustine, one of the early Christian church fathers, who said, "Love and do what you will." This is exactly what he was talking about, this misplaced application of rationality to one's own behavior. Love and do what you will used to be a foundational element of church teaching. Not anymore. I'll talk again about this once a proper foundation has been laid for you to put it into context. This cessation of the transgressive nature isn't a precursor to awakening. This is the culmination of the process. It's the end game. It's what we're all truly hoping to achieve, whether we realize it or not. And in my experience, it's absolutely worth the journey. This is the way it probably should be. You probably don't want to be exposing yourself to the wisdom of those who have not experienced this progression. Quotes, not authority, but wisdom. I've included several quotes throughout this book because I think they add to reading enjoyment. It's nice to read a good quote. Love a good quote. I quote mostly from Jesus, St. Paul, Lao Tzu, though apparently he's not a real guy, as it turns out. Eckhart Tolle, there's the one from St. Augustine, and occasionally Seinfeld, see above. I even quote my own novels from time to time, just for fun. These quotes are included not as authority, but simply for their wisdom. As Father Justin says in the Self-Improvement Book Club Murder, wisdom is self-proving. It needs no canon. If a quote has some resonance with you, great. If not, set it aside. I have a great deal more to say about wisdom, its nature, and where and how to find it throughout this book, as in the novel. Hypothesis versus declarative statement. Please treat any declarative statement you may come across in this book as a hypothesis. This is very important. I will try not to tell you to do anything or think anything or believe anything, and if I do, it's just in the manner of conventional communication. There's no need to trust me or believe me about anything, because the whole point of this book is to get you to do the experiments so you can decide for yourself. Decide about what? The nature of reality. This is a crucial question. Is it manipulable? Or is it fixed, preordained, governed by laws over which you have no control? And is the universe friendly? This is the other crucial question, universe being another word for reality. Is reality benevolent, malevolent, mixed, or neutral? That's part of this inquiry into the nature of reality too, a big part of it. And you have all you need to make up your own mind about all aspects of the nature of reality completely at your disposal. So there's no need to believe anyone about anything, especially me. Just do the experiments and find out for yourself. I'll try to keep my communications within the realm of probability, it could be, rather than the declarative, it is. But if, for the sake of clear communication, I slip up, just take it as a hypothesis. This is a very important distinction, because once you get over into the realm of declarative, the dismalists are going to hit you up for the data. They're going to say, show me the data. And we're not going to be able to give them the data, because all that we're discussing is subjective. Their call for data is based on their assumption that the world is exclusively material, and this just may not be the case. You see what I did there? I said this may not be the case. This keeps the dismalists off our backs about the data, the ubiquitous data. We don't have any data because this is just a hypothesis, that the world is subjective rather than objective, and that it isn't completely material, and maybe not material at all. If it's subjective, there won't be any data. And guess what? This exposes the fact that dismalists don't have any data either. No one does. No one can explain the nature of reality objectively. We can't be objective about it because we're in it. We're part of it. I'll explain all of this and all about the dismalists in a bit. You know a lot of them already. Quotes from my other books. This book was originally conceived as an afterword to a murder mystery I wrote called The Self-Improvement Book Club Murder. In that novel, the main character, an alcoholic detective named John Bookman, discovers a few important truths on his way to solving the murder of Sue Ellen Pincus. Among them are the identity of the Antichrist and a new approach to solving his own addiction. I'll cover both of these items here as well. Spoiler alert, I will be quoting at times from The Self-Improvement Book Club Murder, Bourbon Makes Strange Bedfellows, an earlier version of this novel was published under the title License to Ill, and The Big Granola. Not so much from Healing Seed, the autobiography of Carlos Sanchez. It's a translation, and while spiritual in nature, it's a much different kind of creative work, which is probably an extreme understatement. But even from Healing Seed, I've managed to slip one in. So if you don't want to have the experience of these novels utterly ruined, please go read them now before continuing. Go ahead, we'll wait. Ponder the infinite. For the section breaks, I use infinity symbols. Whenever you see one, take a moment to take a breath and to ponder what you've just read. A map of this book. So where are we going with all this? There are six sections, one for each of the six main experiments that prove the nature of reality, along with 11 bonus experiments sprinkled throughout. Experiment one is about decision-making, a crucial first step toward manipulation of reality. Experiment 2, inner body awareness. This is the core experiment, and it has three parts. Experiment 3 details how drugs impact your connection with your inner body, and there are lots of different drugs out there. Experiment 4 concerns how inner body awareness might be brought to bear to manipulate health and healing. Experiment 5 is devoted to manipulating reality through prayer and the different kinds of prayer. Experiment 6, at long last, Experiment 6. Experiment 6 is all about the dismal religion. I'm going to show you how science is a religion. This is very important to unbrainwashing yourself. This may be very difficult for all but philosophy nerds like myself, but an understanding of what the dismal religion has done to the world is so important. It's key to understanding how you've been brainwashed into believing that you can't impact reality and how you can undo that indoctrination. I'll recount the philosophical history of this long-standing debate between spirituality, religion, and science, and all its implications. And finally, a concluding chapter will wrap everything up, leaving you with a few aphorisms and final thoughts. Feisty Manifesto. In this book, I come out swinging, as the saying goes, with a take-no-prisoners approach, as another saying goes, with regard to religion, and most particularly against the dismal religion, the meaning of which will be explained thoroughly, especially in Experiment 6, which is aptly titled, Let Go of the Dismal Religion. This is primarily for effect, to make the reading more fun. But it's also an approach that is roundly deserved by all you dismalists out there. Dismalism is, without qualification, the most bigoted religion operating in the world today, and they make fun of every other religion unceasingly and unapologetically. This is because they simply don't understand that what they believe is every bit as much a religion as Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, name a religion, it's exactly the same. There's nothing wrong with religion per se. I practice a religion. Religions have a great deal of cultural and social benefit. They can lead you to true spirituality, but they are not true spirituality in and of themselves. True spirituality happens on the inside, subjectively, individually. Having said all this in support of religion, dismalism is by far the absolute worst religion anyone has ever come up with for what it would have you believe. Bonus experiments. You may have noticed upon perusing the table of contents that there are 11 bonus experiments sprinkled like Easter eggs throughout this book, amongst and between the eponymous 6 main experiments. These are gratis, free of charge, pro bono experiments for a total of 17 in all. We aim to give the customer his, her money's worth. Okay, any questions? No? Then let's get started.